My name is Russ Yarrow. I'm manager of public affairs at Chevron, and we are delighted to be a sponsor for this event for the second year in a row. It is the kind of event that really aligns with our philosophy, which is that no matter how big the challenge, if you get smart people around a table who are engaged, you can make things happen and solve great problems and great issues. I stepped out for a couple of minutes this afternoon to buy my water. I walked down the street downtown to Carl's Pharmacy, and I had my Fiji water on the counter. And as I was checking out, the woman behind the register looked at me and she said, "Water will become the new oil." And I thought, my gosh, the Aspen Ideas Festival is starting right now in Carl's Pharmacy. And then I got into a car to come over, and my partner in the car riding over with, I hadn't met him before, but his name is Carl. I don't know if you're here tonight, Carl, but he's going to lead a session later this week on water issues. And so we started talking about oil and water, and against all conventional wisdom, there are a lot of commonalities to oil and water. And I thought that's really the spirit of this event, which is to bring people together and talk about ideas and understand how these ideas share things in common and are integrated. So again, we're delightful to sponsor this event, and I'll hand it over to my colleague Elizabeth Keffer from The Atlantic to introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Russ. And on behalf of The Atlantic and the Aspen Institute, I want to thank Chevron for their partnership this second year here. They were with us last year sponsoring the Energy Futures Track, and we went back to them and said, "Will you join us again?" And they said, "Yes." So we're happy to be here tonight, and I have the great pleasure of introducing Peter Robertson, who is vice chair of the board of Chevron Corporation. It was interesting to read his bio because he grew up at Chevron there now for some three dozen years.
I've grown up.
A Scotsman, as you'll hear, and educated at the University of Edinburgh and then did his MBA at Wharton, and has been in the States for most of his career and has run virtually everything that one could run at Chevron. At one point, he was actually running worldwide exploration, production, and the global gas business. I said there probably is not that much else to the company. In his current job, he has in his portfolio HR, policy, government and public affairs, strategic planning, and corporate compliance. He is chairs the U.S. Energy Association, and in a few of his other postings at Chevron, he has been president of the Chevron Overseas Petroleum, president of Chevron USA, and president of Warren Petroleum Company, which is the former natural gas liquid subsidiary of Chevron. So a long and distinguished career, and he's joining us en route to
Indonesia.
He said Aspen is
on
the way
to Indonesia.
Yes. So he's going to enjoy a good night's sleep tonight in Aspen and then be on a plane all of tomorrow night. So thank you, Peter, for being here.
Thank you.
And we have interviewing him, the distinguished Jim Lehrer. And I said to Jim, "I read your bio today for the first time. I didn't realize you were so prolific. This man has written 16 novels, has his 17th on the way this fall. The 17th will be Eureka. The latest, to give you a little commercial, The Phony Marine, which was published last November. He's also written two memoirs and three plays, but you probably know him better for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, where he is anchor and executive editor, the PBS long-running show. He came to Washington 35 years ago and quickly made his mark. He first teamed with Robert McNeil in 1973 when they were covering the Senate Watergate hearings. And then in 1975 began what turned into the McNeil-Lehrer Report and eventually, as of 83, was called the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour. It was the first 60-minute evening news program on TV. And in 1995, with Robert McNeil's retirement, the program became the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, which is what we know now. He has numerous awards and honors, and in fact, in the past five presidential cycles, he has moderated 10 of the nationally televised presidential debates. And he's also won the Distinguished Presidential National Humanities Medal in 1999. So we are in good hands with Jim Lehrer. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you very much. The other thing you need to know in the interest of transparency and about the great big ideas of Chevron, in addition to underwriting this event and this festival, they also underwrite a television news program, one of the main underwriters of a television news program on PBS called The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, in the interest of transparency. And that's another great big idea that's a really good one of
It's amazing how these coincidences happen, isn't it?
That's how it happens. And speaking of big ideas, and Einstein, which clearly we have been doing since this began today, Einstein had another big idea besides the one that Walter wrote so much about. He gave it very short shrift in his book. But in 1901, Albert Einstein was walking down a dirt road in South Texas between Beaumont and Port Arthur in that general area, and he felt something moving under the ground off to the left. He was with a friend. He walked over and said, "Dig a hole in that ground." And this big, huge geyser of black stuff spewed forth. They called it oil, and that's what brings us here today.
There you go. Spindletop.
If you believe that, you'll believe it. Spindletop, absolutely. Spindletop. If you believe that, you'll believe anything. Peter.
Yes, sir.
Speaking of big ideas, good or bad, the energy bill just passed the Senate. It's about to go to the House. And one of the underpinning ideas of that bill is that gas mileage must be increased. And in this legislation, it's 35 miles a gallon. Is that a good idea from your point of view?
Well, I think first of all, let me say this is a real honor to be interviewed by Jim Lehrer. This is really something, so I'm in awe of that. Energy efficiency is a good idea. And I've got no doubt in my mind that we need to and can become a whole lot more energy efficient in the United States. So I think energy efficiency in autos is really important. I think energy efficiency in buildings, and you know, just hearing a little bit about this building, how little energy this building uses, energy efficiency in everything we do. And you know, in our company, for instance, in the last 15 years, our company is now 27% more energy efficient. We've been focusing on energy efficiency. We use 27% less energy today than we did 15 years ago.
You mean in your own?
In our own company, just the way we run our facilities, which is worth about $2 billion a year in operating expense. So, I mean, there's huge opportunities out there for everybody to become more energy efficient, and I think more energy efficient cars is a good idea. Whether 35 miles to the gallon is the right number, I don't know. But I do think that more energy efficient cars has been demonstrated around the world, and I think we can do it.
We had a representative of the oil industry on our program the day this passed, and she said this was not a good idea. American Petroleum Institute, which is the trade organization, oil industry. And she said the problem is that if you increase gas mileage, you will increase driving, and you will increase the amount of gasoline that is burned.
Well, I mean, you know... You can make up all kinds of arguments. I just think that if you look around the world and see what people are doing and how they're driving cars and how they get much better mileage, you know, maybe it's because I'm from Scotland, but I think we can do better than we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. And I think technology can frankly give us a driving experience that's still a very, very fine driving experience with a lot less energy. So I guess I'm in support of a broad-based effort at increasing energy efficiency. I don't think it should be limited to autos. And in this bill that you're talking about, there's a lot of other energy efficiency items that I think collectively are all, you know, an important step forward. We need to become more energy efficient. And I think government can have an impact on that. I come from California now, and the government of California has had a big impact on energy efficiency over the years. And I was just, in fact, checking this afternoon. I think California is the second most energy efficient state in the United States and more energy efficient than Europe. And slightly less energy efficient than Japan, but way, way more energy efficient than the United States. So government can have an impact. Standards can be good things. Appliances, buildings, cars. I think we need to really work on that. It's an important source of energy.
An important source of energy. Put it
on
the list.
Instead of a roundabout way, it's a source of energy.
Absolutely, because of what is not used. But put it on the list of the big picture about if we are going to, quote, solve the energy problem that we have, not only in this country, but in this world, where does efficiency come? We're talking big ideas here. What are the big solutions?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, I think that in the next 25 years, we expect the demand for energy in the world to grow by 50%.
Increase
by 50% from where we are today.
And that's all kinds of energy?
All kinds of energy. I mean, coal, nuclear, whatever, but all kinds of energy. And that factors in some energy efficiency around the world. So there's a huge increase coming. So we need to...
Let me stop you there. Yeah. This is inevitable just because of the developing world is going to develop and they're going to need energy to do it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the... In fact, somebody was saying today that... that the Renault and Nissan are developing cars that they're going to sell in China and India for $3,000. So these are, you know, these are gasoline-driven or diesel-driven, I don't know which, one of both each, but gasoline-driven cars that are going to, and so when you've got, you know, 2 billion people that are finally, with a bit of luck, finding their way out of poverty here, and energy is a crucial component of getting, increasing your standard of living, yes, it is inevitable to me that there's going to be some enormous demand on the energy system. Now, what level is inevitable? I mean, I think if we get a lot better at efficiency, you know, we can ameliorate that a little bit, but we're going to have a big increase in demand for energy. That's inevitable.
All right. Now, where does fossil fuel and gasoline and oil and all of those things that come under that heading fit?
Well, you know, right now, this coal and natural gas, I mean, petroleum in the world is about 40% of the total energy. And natural gas is about 20%. Coal is about 25%. So I think if you add all that up, you get about 85%. Mm-hmm. I hope nobody's checking, but I think it's somewhere
sounds,
about
sounds
that.
Sounds about right. Yeah, right.
Somewhere about that, you get 85%. Okay. On top of that, you get some nuclear, maybe 5 or 6%, mm-hmm. and then everything else, renewables and, you know, wood and all kinds of things that people burn around the world that are about the last few percentage points. So it seems to us that with this surging demand, we're going to need to tap all of these sources of energy. Now, you know, which is a huge challenge. So that includes oil and it includes gas and it includes coal, but it certainly includes renewables. It includes biofuels that a lot of work we're doing today and others are. It includes the nuclear, you know, power. We have to have more of that. And then if that's not complicated enough to do all of that to supply this energy demand, in comes sort of climate change and environmental requirements, and the complexity of the puzzle then gets really difficult. And I mean, that's the big challenge here, I think, is some of these, clearly coal is challenged from a CO2 perspective. Oil is challenged from a CO2 perspective. So then that's when we've got to really dig into our technology toolbox and get much better at figuring out how to make fossil fuels work. Because I would say at the end of the day, there is no way that we're going to be able to live without them. The world's not going to advance the way
there's
the world's
no
going to advance.
There's no idea big enough to do away with fossil
fuels. Not that I'm aware of and not that anybody's aware of. But we would be wrong to say that it's all going to be solved by fossil fuels, because it's not. Renewable fuels are going to be really important. Nuclear power is important, frankly. I think that's got issues.
Well, explain your thinking on nuclear, because that is not a major source of energy in the United States of America. It is in other parts of the world, but it isn't here.
Well,
you think it's going to happen?
I think it's got to happen.
Why does it got to happen?
Well, it's got to happen because without frankly, all of these sources of energy, you know, nuclear power in the United States actually is going to get less, you know, as some of these old power plants become, you know, outlive their certification. So unless we do something in the United States, nuclear power is going to become less. I would say, at least in the world, it's going to be a part of the solution. Whether we can get it done in the United States or not, I'm not sure. There's some pretty thoughtful people, I guess the pair from New Mexico, I mean, you know, Bingham and Domenici. Certainly Domenici is a big supporter of nuclear power, and maybe it's got something to do with them being uranium in New Mexico. But nevertheless, I mean, there are some supporters of nuclear power in the government. I think nuclear power is, frankly, we think it's a very clean fuel, a clean power. Obviously, there's issues associated with the waste, but I guess I'm a believer enough in technology that those can be solved. But we've kind of got to get behind and spend money on the technology and moving some of these things forward, as opposed to debating who's going to win and who's going to lose here.
Are you into nuclear in a big way, Chevron?
We are not in nuclear, never have been. And we came very close to it at one time, but we managed to avoid it. But I do think it's going to be part of the solution. And they seem to have solved the problem in France, and they seem to have solved the problem in Japan, mm-hmm. which are, you know, Japan particularly is a very, very environmentally conscious country, and yet they've solved the problem of nuclear waste there. So it seems to me that there are some of these are tremendous technology challenges. Carbon sequestration is a tremendous technology challenge, but, you know, we've dealt with technology challenges before. We need to focus on carbon sequestration. We need to focus on nuclear power, waste, and get on with it instead of all this fussing about who's going to win.
Speaking of, more importantly,
who's going to lose.
Oh, who's going to lose, right. What is the leading technological problem in the fossil fuel part of your business? Mm-hmm. What is it you're trying to solve right now?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a lot of people talk about peak oil, you know, that somehow oil production in the world is going to peak because it's running out.
That's right.
And, you know, our view would be, and frankly, you know, if anybody's interested, there's going to be a study, I think maybe the most important study on climate change is about to be published, called the National Petroleum Council, and it's got a broad range of people that are involved in this long way past the petroleum industry. But they're going to talk about peak oil, and they're going to answer Secretary Bodman's question on peak oil. But I would say that we're never going to run out of oil. But you know, somebody once said the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stone. You know, somebody came along with a better idea, and I don't think we're ever going to run out of oil. But I do think that it's becoming, for lots of reasons, more and more difficult to produce the oil that's in the ground. Either it's because the water's deeper, or the desert's harsher, or the Arctic is colder, or the politics are more difficult. Impossible. You know, so it's all of these, what we would call above ground risks, that are making straining the supply of petroleum in the world and natural gas. And at the end of the day, they're going to be the thing, I think, particularly the politics, frankly, that are going to eliminate our ability to grow any further. So I do think that in, you know, 10 to 15 years, the sort of non-OPEC part of the world is probably going to peak in terms of its ability to produce oil. So that's a big, you know, they've got a big issue. It's not going to grow beyond that.
Well, when you say the politics, what do you mean specifically? What kind of politics?
Well, I come from California. We can't drill for oil offshore California.
And that's a bad thing?
Well, it was a bad thing when we invested $1 billion off there and then we're told to go away. That was a bad thing. You know, we got one story. I'll get off the United States in a minute. Sure. But, you know, we bought some leases from the U.S. government in the Gulf of Mexico in a place called Destin Dome probably 15 years ago now, not far from Florida. We drilled a bunch of wells. We discovered a lot of gas, natural gas, no oil in it, clean natural gas. We submitted a development plan to the government. It was turned down. Finally, the government basically insisted that we give back the leases. So I like to say the only place that we've been nationalized in the last in my career, short of Venezuela, you know, in the 70s, was in America. Mm-hmm. But what did we do? Because we couldn't produce that natural gas in Florida, we went off to Angola and we drilled a lot of wells in Angola and we built an LNG facility in Angola. We built ships to bring the gas to
natural gas, right?
Natural gas to, mm-hmm. To Florida. We built a terminal on the Gulf Coast to put it in a pipeline and send it to Florida. Now, I mean,
your future.
That's what we're doing now. I mean, we're in the process of building that LNG facility.
You extrapolate that ahead and you see.
I'm saying because the politics, I would call that a political risk, because the politics in the United States, in that particular area of Florida, made it impossible for us to produce natural gas there, that we're having to go elsewhere in the world. Somebody else is going to allow us to drill wells in their backyard. We're going to spend, I think it's like $9 billion on this project. And we're going to bring this gas to Florida, and the people in Florida are going to get natural gas. But it seems arrogant as a nation that we should do that. But it just seems pretty impractical, too, and it seems like if we want to be less dependent mm-hmm. on the rest of the world, and I'm going to avoid energy independence here, but if we want to be less dependent, which I think is a good thing, then that's not a good way to go around being less dependent.
Being... The phrase we must stop being dependent on foreign oil to restrict it beyond natural gas, it's restricted to oil. That's hallucination, is it not?
Well, I think it is, but I think the idea that we should not be overly dependent on any one regime or any one group in the world is a worthy goal. I don't think that we should be held hostage, and that's probably the wrong term to use because I just got some hostages back in Nigeria and my own company. But we should. I think that spreading our risk and having lots of sources of energy and lots of sources of oil and gas around the world, I think that's a good thing. So that means that's got lots of implications for our foreign policy. It's got lots of implications for the way we run our business in Washington. So apart from increasing the energy production in the United States from a whole variety of sources, one of which is oil and gas, I think that maintaining a breadth of relationships in the world. And working on relationships around the world so that we have lots of different sources of oil and gas, I think that's really important because I think if we do get to a point where we're dependent on anybody, that's a bad thing, and I certainly support independence from that perspective.
But as a general rule, rule of thumb for your company and other like companies, the major oil companies, you all have pretty much made the decision that the future supplies are not in the United States. They're overseas, right?
The opportunities for us are largely overseas, although we're still spending, you know, $6 billion this year or something like that in the United States. So it's not like we're
walked away.
We just made some huge discoveries in the Gulf of Mexico, which were very well publicized, in very deep water in the Gulf of Mexico, using state-of-the-art technology. And there's more to be found in the United States. I mean, somebody estimates that, you know, maybe the USGS or whatever, there's maybe 115 billion barrels of oil to be found in the United States, if you, you know, if you could explore everywhere. And I'm not recommending that, frankly, because we've had some bad experiences and sometimes it's not worth it.
You also say the politics wouldn't allow it even if you wanted.
But the politics elsewhere, which is really a question elsewhere in the world.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, we're just dealing with Venezuela. I mean, they're tough in lots of places.
Explain the Venezuela thing to us.
Well, you know, in Chevron's history, if you go back to 1946, we discovered a big oil field in Venezuela. In 1976, and we produced it for 30 years. In 1976, we were nationalized, along with the rest of the industry. The whole oil industry was thrown out of Venezuela. In 1996, lots of sixes in this one. In 1996, they had an opening, apertura, they called it. The industry was invited back in. We actually went back to the old oil field that we were producing all these years. A lot of the employees that we'd had, the Venezuelans, came back to work for Chevron, which they were very happy about. And we produced that oil till 2006. In 2006, the government of Venezuela decided to change the deal. And so we negotiated with the government and ended up with a deal that we thought was reasonable, pretty acceptable from our perspective. I mean, there was we lost a little bit on it, but not a lot. So we ended up with a new deal in Boscan. Now, here in the last few months, the president of Venezuela decided that they wanted to do the same thing in this big area of heavy oil in Venezuela, where there's a whole bunch of companies involved. And so Exxon and BP and Conoco and Chevron and a variety of other companies, Total, and of course the Venezuelan national company in there. So he said, I want Venezuela to own 60%. Of all, even though we only own in some 30% and some 20% and some 40%, I'm going to own 60%. So we entered into a negotiation with the Venezuelans. All their companies entered into a negotiation with the Venezuelans. And while it's not, these are not signed deals at this point, so there's probably not much I can say, it's evident from our own releases and from the press that we've decided we've got an acceptable deal with the Venezuelans and we're going to stay. And the two other big American companies, ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips, at least haven't. Conoco says we're gone.
Yeah.
Exxon,
in
good fair tradition, says we're working on it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you don't know what that means. But I think clearly they're having a tough time negotiating something. At the end of the day, who won? I don't know. We think we got an acceptable deal. Our business is to stay in these countries, to continue to produce oil. We think we do a lot better job of it than anybody else, frankly, of course, we think that. We know we do a lot better job of it than some of the government companies around the world. So we think that the world's better off, and we think the United States is better off, and we're sure Chevron's better off by us staying in Venezuela, by us continuing to look for opportunities in the future in Venezuela. Regimes come and go. You know, regimes change. I mean, 1946 was when we started there. There's been lots of regimes since then. And so we lived through this. And we have, you'd be amazed, actually, we have pretty decent relationships with the working people in the government in Venezuela.
Take Venezuela as a specific and move it to more general premise that people often hear that, hey, wait a minute, this is our oil. This is Venezuela's mm-hmm. oil. We should have the right to develop the way we want to, and whatever profits come out of the ground should be ours. We shouldn't have to share them with Chevron, ExxonMobil, and all these big American oil companies. How do you respond to that kind of stuff?
What is their oil? But if we can bring a proposition to them that says, look, we can bring some technology, we can bring some expertise, we can bring some capital sometimes. Today, capital, everybody's got capital, so that really doesn't get you very much. But technology and expertise and know-how, and we can organize this thing, we can do, around the world we do lots of community projects. In Venezuela, we've refurbished, I don't know how many orphanages at this point. It's not that the government of Venezuela doesn't have money to do it, they just haven't done it. But, you know, in the communities where companies like ours, and we're not the only one, where we operate, we do some, I think, pretty phenomenal things for the community. And so I think it can be in the people of Venezuela's interest to have us there. I mean, most of these deals around the world now, the government gets about 90%. Mm-hmm. In Saudi Arabia, our deal, they get 90%. In Indonesia, the government gets 90%, but the 10% is enough to make us a profit, and give us a reasonable return on our investment. And so we think there's a deal that can be struck, and usually it turns out that way, that we can bring something to them and they can deliver something to them. But it is their oil. So we've got to earn our right to stay there every day.
Do when you negotiate, when you and your fellow oil companies negotiate with, whether it's Nigeria, Venezuela, any of these countries, do they see you as a representative of the United States of America, or what?
Well, they often attribute a lot more power to us than we deserve. Mm-hmm. I mean, so in many cases, they do think of us as a representative. I mean, we're an American company, so they do consider us as a representative of the United States. In these countries, our employees are 90% nationals. I mean, in America, we're 90% Americans, and in Nigeria, we're 90% Nigerians, and in Angola, we're 87%, I think, Angolans. So our company is basically made up of people from the host country. But they do think of us as an American company, and oftentimes they think that we can make things happen in Washington. We usually can't, but oftentimes, it sometimes helps us when they think we can.
Yeah. Does the U.S. government, are they by your side when you negotiate?
No.
They have no involvement at all?
I shouldn't say they're not fighting us, but they're not there.
You're there as individuals.
We're there as individuals, absolutely, as a company. And, the U.S. government has played a role in some sort of infrastructure things. For instance, pipelines out of the Caspian area. And the U.S. government played a strong role in actually not pushing our pipeline, pushing a competing pipeline, but pushing the access for Central Asian oil to the West. In other words, getting it out of the sort of former Soviet sphere. So the U.S. government, frankly, was very, very helpful. And this was during the Clinton administration. Both the president and vice president were involved in helping the industry, not helping really any particular company, because they've got to be very careful that are helping Exxon or helping Chevron or helping Conoco or the others get kind of. But they were helping the industry work with some of these governments to get routes for pipelines out of there. So on occasion, with big sort of infrastructure things like that, they can help. But when we're negotiating deals, it's Chevron that's negotiating it, nobody else.
Let's go from a big picture to a little picture, but would be a big picture to the people who would be forming this question. Why are gasoline prices so high at the pump?
Well, they're not.
In the United States of America? Okay. Well, all right, let me rephrase the question. Why have gasoline prices risen so high?
Well, I think for all the reasons I've been talking about, the world is growing. I mean, we've had increases in oil prices over the years that have been caused by somebody cutting us off, people shutting things in. That's sort of what we would call a supply-oriented shock. What's happening this time is on the other side of the equation, sort of a demand-oriented thing. I mean, the world's growing. And these huge population centers of the world, China and India and Southeast Asia and, frankly, the United States, are their demand for energy is continuing to grow and growing, frankly, at quite a rate. And for all the reasons I was describing about the difficulty of some of the political situations around the world, but certainly some of the technologies that we need to get to some of these places and the timelines that it takes to get some of these projects put together, the supply system's really constrained. And so world oil prices are up, and that's not something that, Chevron's 2% of the world's oil business, of the world's oil business, 2%. So Exxon's about, they're a bit bigger, they're about 4%. So we're not managing the price of oil in the world. We're part of that system. So world oil prices are up, and that's about 50% of the price of gasoline is crude oil. The other 50% is made up of, about a third of the other 50, about 15 or 16% probably is taxes, and those are state taxes and federal taxes, and then the other piece is refining and marketing and sort of distribution, transportation, all that stuff. And the other reason that gasoline prices most recently have been up is because of the strain on the U.S. refining system. The U.S. refining system is operating at pretty close to capacity, and demand continues to go up. The U.S. refining system continues to grow, but it's not growing fast enough to keep up with the demand in the United States. So so we've had high oil prices that have been a big part of it, and tight refining. Now, there's one other thing that's kind of going on in this country too, and that's in effect making the system a lot more inefficient. And that is, we've got what we call the boutique fuel problem. We've got 18 blends of gasoline or types of formulas of gasoline in the United States. California's got its special blend. You know, Memphis, Tennessee's got a blend. Birmingham, Alabama's got a blend. Chicago's got a blend. And these are all different formulas for gasoline. So effectively, if there's a shortage in one area and you've got a surplus in another area, it's very difficult to move. You know, the refinery in this area is tuned to fix this for this blend. The refinery over here is for this blend. So by the complexity that we've introduced into the system, and now by introducing state-by-state ethanol mandates or specs, rather than a federal mandate, but state-by-state, we're compounding that issue. So we're making the whole supply system very complex and effectively reducing capacity. So the combination of that, refineries being pretty tight anyway, and high oil prices, is causing where we are today. But if you look back at, you know, I think 20 years, I think 20 years ago, out of people's income, 3% was going to gasoline, and today, 3% is going to gasoline.
But as you know, Peter,
I know.
An awful lot of people don't buy what you just said on the grounds.
That's why I'm here.
Yeah, but it's coming at a time. All this is happening. Gasoline prices are going up. Your profits are going up.
Yes.
Yours and all the other oil companies are going
yes.
up. And the connection is being made all the time. How do you is the connection?
I'll tell you the connection. I mean, the prices are up because supply is constrained. When supply of any product, orange juice in Florida, when there's a frost, price of orange juice goes up. The supply is constrained. Prices are going up. We're an investment vehicle, and so our job is to invest our earnings, and we do. And so last year we earned $17 billion, which is an astronomical number by anybody's measure. But this year we're going to invest $20 billion in oil and gas and refineries around the world. Over the last 5 years, we've earned $53 billion, and we've invested $53 billion. Now, the precise number is a coincidence, but it's a fact. So we invest, and prices are going up. That tells us the market's saying we need more investment, we need more supply. Prices go up, we have more money to invest, we invest it, and hopefully that'll bring on the supply over time. That's how that equation works.
But the first part of the equation, you said, was that the cost is going up. So if the cost is going up, why is the profit going up? I mean, in other words, wouldn't the cost and the price go up at the same time, at the same level? In other words, if your costs go up 15%, wouldn't the cost of gasoline go up 15%? But it's much higher than that, is it not? In other words,
but it's a market. Again, if you go back to the orange juice in Florida, I mean, when the frost hits and a lot of farmers lose their crops, the other guys now there's a shortage. The other guys sell their orange juice. Their cost is still the same as it was, but they sell their orange juice for a higher price. I mean, the market, if there's a shortage, the market will force prices up in order to get more investment, and that's what's happening here. It's a supply. I mean, it's the age-old. You know, somebody's saying Dan Yergin, wrote this book about the oil industry, The Prize, the last 100 years of the oil industry, and he said the two main the two main characters were supply and demand, throughout this book, and that is it's a fact. I mean, the supply is tight right now in the world, the supply of refining capacity is tight in the world, and the market is forcing prices up because there's a shortage, or there's a tightness anyway. And there's lots of other reasons, some of which I just described.
Sure.
But the market's forcing the prices up, and that's telling us, we're earning lots of money, but we're putting it all back into investments. The people that are benefiting from, the company being successful, frankly, and earning money are all the folks that have mutual funds and pension plans and everything that has Chevron stock in it. So it's not like, we're sort of wheeling this out the door and back door in wheelbarrows or something like that. We're either returning it to our shareholders who've invested in our company, or we're reinvesting in the business at levels that were, if somebody had said to me 5 years ago we'd be investing at $20 billion a year, I'd have told them they were crazy.
What are you investing the $20 billion in?
Well, I said probably $6 billion in the United States and probably...
But in what?
In drilling wells in the Gulf of Mexico as much as anything, in building platforms. We've got this Tahiti project that's been in the press a lot recently. It's a $3.5 billion project. It's going to produce... In our terms, going to produce 150,000 barrels a day of oil out of the Gulf of Mexico. It's in 5,000 feet of water. The other project that's been in the press a lot called Jack is in 7,000 feet of water. That's the water before you start drilling the well. The well's, you know, the oil's 5 miles down. You know, and so these are multi-billion dollar projects. We've got in our portfolio today, we've got 30 individual projects for which our share of the project is more than $1 billion. 30 of them. Most of them, I would say 25 of them, 28 of them are probably oil and gas producing projects, just like Tahiti, deep water Angola, big expansion in Kazakhstan, big expansion in Indonesia, the Venezuelan project we're just talking about, Thailand drilling gas wells. I mean, most of it's about drilling wells, constructing facilities to produce oil and gas.
As a general premise then, you have no apologies to make or any embarrassment at all about these high profits that your company and other companies are
No, I'm not remotely embarrassed about it. I mean, I'm proud of what we do as a company, and I'm proud of the contribution we're making to the energy supply of the world. I'm also proud of the fact that we're spending, you know, billions of dollars on trying to find renewables and alternatives. So, you know, we've spent, I think the number I saw just is, you know, over the next 3 years, we're going to spend $2.5 billion on renewables. You know, we're the biggest geothermal company in the world. We produce, you know, you can only produce, actually this building is powered by geothermal, but I'm talking about steam in the ground. Yeah. You can only do that where there is steam in the ground, and where we do it is in Indonesia and the Philippines, but we produce, you know, 1,200 megawatts of power, which is a very large power business from geothermal steam. We're in the ethanol business. We've got a whole bunch of research programs on trying to crack a series of codes on converting agricultural waste and forest products and those things into ethanol. But even if we're wildly successful at that, which I think we will be, frankly, I think we'll be very successful at it. We've just structured a joint venture. We're in the process of structuring a joint venture with Weyerhaeuser. You know, Weyerhaeuser is the largest timber company in the United States. They're you know, they know all about the science of trees and, you know, land.
What are you doing with them?
Well, they have a lot of waste products. They have a lot of wood chips and sawdust and but trees. And they have a lot of acreage where perhaps between the trees you could grow things. You know, so we know how to make fuels. And I mean, you know, all these things are just you know, they're just about 6 million years late. I mean, all that stuff's the same stuff that all went down in the ground and got compressed, and now we find it with oil. So we're kind of moving back up the chain a little bit, and now we're dealing with live, but there's still carbons and hydrogens all mixed up together. They're almost hydrocarbons. They got a little oxygen in there, so we call them, something else. But they're essentially hydrocarbons. So we know how to take all those chemical elements and formulate them into fuels. Weyerhaeuser know how to grow them, and you know, they know a lot about the chemistry of growing them and what the various products are, what grows best, and so on and so forth. So between us, it's sort of like they're the upstream. They're the folks that are drilling the wells, and we're the folks that are making the fuels. So we're not there yet. There's a lot of technology to be developed here yet, but I mean, we're working with some really serious ventures to try and make this stuff happen. But as I say, even if we're wildly successful, and I think we will be, it's probably going to be, you know, it could be 10 or 15% of our energy supply sometime in the future.
What is it now?
Right now, we start with gasoline. Right now, it's 3% of the U.S. gasoline supply is ethanol. 3%. Now we're using 13% of the U.S. corn crop.
Okay.
So if we used all the U.S. corn crop, we'd be up to, you guys can do the math, but, you know, 40% or something. I mean, 30%. So we wouldn't be, we can't use all the U.S. corn crop because then it shows up in everything, the cost of everything else. But we think that probably from the U.S. corn crop, with the advances that are being made there, that we can get maybe 10% of our gasoline supply coming from food sources. So to get beyond 10%, what we've really got to do is find a way to use the waste products, the corn stalks and the switchgrass and all these other things, trees and wood pulp and wood chips and cardboard and lots of waste in California, artichoke plants and all these things.
Oh, not artichoke.
Oh, well, not the artichokes, but you got this little thing this size and then you got the plant that's this size.
I got
it's this thing I'm talking about. So but we can make that stuff into fuels.
Yeah, but there's still no big idea. No big thing that's going to suddenly revolutionize this and make it go beyond 10% or 20 or make it something.
Well, the president's program is 20%.
20%.
The Congress is essentially talking about 20%.
Right.
So I'm saying about 10 of it can come from the food based, and the rest of it's got to come from new technology that we're working on. But it's still only 20% of our gasoline supply. Yeah. It's not nothing to do with buildings or now. I mean, the big idea always was hydrogen. Mm-hmm. You know, so far that's a long way in the future. I mean, we have hydrogen stations.
What's the problem? What's been the problem with the hydrogen?
Well, the problem with hydrogen, you know, everything that we play with ourselves is just a bunch of carbons and hydrogens all mixed together in different formulas. And so all you got to do is take the carbons off and do something with them and use the hydrogen. And that we can do that. But what do you do with the carbons? I mean, there's now you've got CO2, basically. So what do you do with the carbons? And the scale of the business and the scale of this carbon sequestration project is just so enormous that we haven't found any sort of economic way of doing it yet that's acceptable from an environmental perspective. Yeah. So there's a huge challenge, but it's a challenge we ought to be, you know,
people
we ought to be
working on it.
Yeah, I mean we do have some hydrogen stations. I mean, but in a way, our hydrogen stations are the hydrogen comes from natural gas. You know, so you've got, in the United States, we've got a natural gas infrastructure all over the United States, pipelines and people's homes. So we've got these hydrogen stations. You site it on top of a natural gas pipeline. You extract natural gas from the pipeline. You put it through this little black box, and you produce hydrogen, and it goes in a car. But the CO2 goes in the air.
And that's
enough. And the hydrogen is bloody expensive. Yeah. And we've got a bus fleet in Oakland, California. They're running on hydrogen, three buses. Each of them costs $3 million. Each of the buses. You know, so I mean, we're just learning right now. We're learning how to make the buses. We're learning how to make the hydrogen. We've got to learn how to make it in an environmentally acceptable way. And we've got to learn to do it, I guess, at less than $3. And today we're just not there.
Look, those of you who have questions, there are microphones on either side in the aisle. If you go and stand in line, and we will alternate left to right, and you can do that while I ask Peter another question. Falls out of something you said earlier about, you mentioned taxes. Mm-hmm. And as you know, part of the energy legislation was aimed at raising the taxes on you all. It didn't make it in the Senate, although some people in the House say they're going to still. There's been a lot of
And they passed some stuff earlier in the year in the House.
Why shouldn't you all pay more taxes?
Well, we pay a lot of taxes. I mean, we pay an enormous amount of taxes. We pay, I think, you know, our fair share of taxes. You know, I'm frankly not inalterably opposed to paying some more taxes, but I am inalterably opposed to a Senate bill that has $30 billion of taxes for a whole suite of pet projects. I mean, the list is this high. Everybody's pet project is in there. They add it all up, it's $30 billion, so let's charge the top five U.S. companies $30 billion. Because to the extent that, you know, if I earned $17 billion last year and I'm investing 20 this year, if you take away three, I got 14 to invest, the level of investment's going to go down. I mean, it's not a threat. It's been demonstrated in the past when we had the windfall profits tax in the United States in the 70s. Production in the United States went down. Went down by 8%.
You think it would happen again?
Absolutely. It would absolutely happen because if many, many billions of dollars were sucked out of this industry and just to pay for, you know, a whole variety of things, many of which may be good, the investment in the base business is going to go down. I mean, that's a scientific fact. And so I think that very, very huge punitive taxes is a mistake. You know, the House passed a bill in January, I think it was, where they had what I would call, you know, a little bit more modest tax increase. It probably would have cost Chevron about $500 million a year or something like that, so it wasn't exactly small. But they passed that. We didn't fight that hard. You know, it was a manufacturer's tax deduction allowance thing that was supposed to encourage jobs in the United States, which I think it did. But we were at least that law would take it away from us. Those things are one thing. Taking away the idea of some of the really large things that have been floated, take away the foreign tax credit, for example, means that our American companies become completely uncompetitive around the world.
Why? Why would that?
Because the United States is the only country in the world that taxes worldwide income, the only developed country in the world that taxes worldwide income. In other words, if we earn money in Saudi Arabia, it's taxable in the United States. If we earn money in Poland, it's taxable in the United States. If Total earned money in Saudi Arabia, it's not taxable in France. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia taxes it, and
that's it.
So in order to level the playing field there, we have this thing called foreign tax credits. So, and even on a personal basis, if you earn money overseas, it's taxable in the U.S., but you get a foreign tax credit. So you get to deduct from your taxes the taxes you paid in the other country. One of the proposals is to take away that. So that would mean that American companies have to pay Saudi tax or Polish tax or Kazakh tax and American tax on the same income. When we're competing for projects, Venezuela or wherever it is around the world, we would be uncompetitive. I mean, we would not be able to compete for those projects. So we say that's short-sighted. That's just going to reduce the supply of oil in the world, or else maybe you're happy with the Chinese and the French producing that oil around the world. I would say that's not a good idea. I'd say you'd want American companies in those countries. I think you want American companies in Venezuela. I think you want American companies in Saudi Arabia, and I think you want American companies in Kazakhstan. I mean, we do bring, you know, some of the great things about America with us, and we do. I think that's very important. So I think there's going to be some tax. But let me give you an example.
Sure. Okay.
Back home in California last year, we had something called Proposition 87. And Proposition 87 was a proposal. You know, in California, when the government can't decide, they just put it on the ballot and let the people decide. So they had this Proposition 87, and the core of it was they would put a tax on oil production in California, tax the oil companies. Sounds like a good thing in California, right? And they would take that money, and a commission in Sacramento would create a pot of $10 billion, and they would spend that on alternate fuel projects. It was turned down in California. Now, you would think taxing oil companies for alternate fuels would fly. If it flies anywhere, it would fly in California. It got turned down. And it got turned down, I think, for two reasons. One, because people said, sounds like higher gasoline prices to us. You know, I mean, didn't sound like, and second thing they didn't like was the idea of big government having a big pot full of money to spend on undefined projects. And in fact, even the commission that was put together, you could argue was, you know, conflicted anyway. But probably shouldn't go too far there. But so I think people
don't. Some would argue that that's what government is all about. I mean, you collect for the general good, and you then decide. Government then decides what the good is at any particular time.
Yeah.
What you're arguing against is collecting special taxes for specific quote goods that involve alternative fuels or something, and collecting from you specifically.
I'm saying it's short-sighted to. It's killing the golden goose. I mean, everybody knows we need a hell of a lot of investment in this oil and gas business. Nobody's asking for any help. We're just saying, let us invest what we have in this oil and gas business, because we'll produce more oil and gas. And we will support, and we are supporting, and let's all support the development of alternate fuels. And we will support things that help technology, build technology for alternate fuels. We'll support a lot of things, but just a huge big bucket of money for these people to spend? No, we don't support that.
I've got to read you a quote from John McCain, which we're talking about all the things you've talked about, understandably, about all the things that you've been doing, the oil industry's doing, and you know who McCain is, Senator Arizona. And he said, quote, outside of satanic cults, these people have the worst PR of anybody in the world. He's talking about the oil industry.
Probably proven the point tonight. But
yeah. Well, why is that? Why, if you've spent almost an hour here making the case, have you all made your case often enough, or you've made it poorly? What's the problem?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we have, clearly the oil industry over many, many, many years has not done a good job at educating, educating the public on our business and what makes it go and why it's important or why it's not important, how it works. God knows we've spent, in the last few years, I mean, we were out in front, our company was out in front of this issue saying, look, supply systems, this is what's happening. India and China, this is what's happening. Efficiency is important. You know, biofuels are important. We spent about 2 years, trying to get people to listen to this issue. And now they've listened, and now we wish we'd never asked for it. But it's an enormous struggle to educate America. I mean, this is a complex puzzle we've got. It's being made more complex by a lot of the environmental conditions we have now. But I think it's a complex puzzle, and I think the leadership, and I'll say the oil industry has not done a good job on this. I think our leadership's done a stinking job on it. I mean, I think and I've said this before, I think it's misleading for the President of the United States to stand up and say that we should be energy independent. I mean, I just think that leads people to believe we can be, and for the life of me, I've got no idea how we could possibly be. If he stood up and said, look, it's really important that we are not overly dependent on one contingent of people in the world or whatever. I think that's okay, and we can all strive to reduce the dependence. But as soon as you say we're going to be energy independent, I mean, all of the producers in the world say, well, that's fine. If they don't want it, we'll just send it to China. I mean, we're not helping ourselves with all these comments, and we get the most incredible insults from which I guess are politically intentioned, and maybe people must like them. But we get these incredible insults like that, and you say, what in the world did we do to deserve that? And we're just a bunch of regular people coming, trying to use technology to produce oil and gas, and frankly, haven't done not a bad job of it over a 1,000 years or 100 years, given the complexities of it. So, you know, this product that that you buy every day in your car is still cheaper, a hell of a lot cheaper than this stuff per gallon. It probably doesn't taste as good, but it's a whole lot cheaper. Yeah, you know, and if you look and see what it takes to get it, and the you know, whether you got to go and you know, drill wells in the jungle in Papua New Guinea and build a whole production system and build a pipeline and build ships and refineries and whatever to get that product to you, and you can, I don't know whether this is taken out of the river there, but you can go to you know, to a spring.
Comes from Fiji.
Okay, but I mean, you can run water through a filter and sell it for more than we get for a gasoline. So, I mean, it's a huge issue for us. It's a huge challenge for society. It's a must-have product that people have to have. So volatility is the big problem, I think. Mm-hmm. I think the $3 isn't so much the big problem as when people plan for $2 and all of a sudden it's $3. That's a huge problem.
Life changes.
It's kind of funny. This is the only product. I think this is probably the only product where people really are buying a commodity. I mean, a pure commodity. You know, most things, if you buy cars, you know, you're buying some steel, but there's a whole lot of other things that go into it as well. But this is almost sort of a pure commodity. So you really get exposed directly to the commodity cycles. People, individuals get exposed directly to the commodity cycles, and that is really hard on individual budgets. And so, I mean, I don't mean to say this is an important issue. It's a hugely important issue, but it's a very complex issue and something we sure as hell need a lot better education in the United States of people and better understanding and better dialogue, and we need, frankly, more leadership. I think the leadership's rotten in this subject.
Okay. Question.
Okay. Thank you very much. My name is Arthur Mutambara from Zimbabwe. One of the challenges we have in poor countries, like most countries in Africa, is the nature of our industries, the nature of our economies. We're busy producing raw materials and selling raw materials and importing refined products. And we don't want that. We're moving towards value-added manufacturing. We're moving towards beneficiation. In particular, in the oil industry, don't you think it would be a good idea for Chevron and other oil companies to do their refining in Africa, the refining in Nigeria, so that you bring refined products to Europe, to America, so that you can create more jobs in Africa. You can make those products, gasoline, petrol, diesel, available in Africa. Right now, we have a travesty of justice in Nigeria, where there's actually a shortage of petrol, a shortage of diesel, and yet they are one of the major producers of oil. And lastly, human rights. Does Chevron and all the corporations in the oil industry have any views on human rights? Any views on the values of democracy and freedom? Would you be operating in Nazi Germany as Chevron?
No.
And what are you doing about human rights in Nigeria, in
Venezuela,
and so on and so forth? Thank you very much.
Yeah. We invested, I mean, the one best example, we invested $1 billion in Sudan and walked away from it because the situation there just got so bad that it was just intolerable. But in terms of, you know, the United States today imports a huge amount of products. We import oil that everybody knows about. We also import gasoline, and we import diesel fuel, and we import jet fuel. And a lot of that comes from, frankly, developing countries. I mean, we're building lots of the industry, and us included, are building refineries in India. We're building, you know, Korea's a whole lot more developed country at this point. I mean, it's a very developed country, but we're building refining capacity in Korea. We're building refining capacity. We have refining capacity in Thailand, which we built. We've got refining capacity in Singapore. And we're building refining capacity in lots of... We have refining capacity in South Africa, Cape Town. So we've got refining capacity in lots of places in the world. Not every country can afford to have its own refinery. And frankly, it's more expensive for a lot of countries to have their own refinery. The refining system in Nigeria, they have plenty of refineries in Nigeria. They just don't work. You know, and getting them working is a huge challenge, for lots of reasons that are, you know, very complex in Nigeria. But, you know, in our industry, more and more, the countries are requiring what they call local, much more local content. So when we build a lot of these big production projects, these big platforms offshore or very complex things, countries are requiring much more be built in the country. So we're creating a lot more jobs in the country, in Nigeria particularly. We're building lots of these modules for offshore facilities. So we're stretching. We're building the capability in Nigeria to build offshore platforms and to build a lot of that stuff. That capability doesn't exist there. If we weren't there, I can assure you there's a lot of Chinese companies in Africa. They're not building anything in Nigeria. They're not, or in Angola. They're not using Nigerian laborers or Angolans. They're basically doing it with Chinese labor. So we're a big part of building the infrastructure in some of these countries. It's a long way from perfect, that's for sure. And the Nigerian system is probably the most difficult of all. I mean, it's just a very, very complicated. They got all kinds of difficulties in Nigeria. But we are, I think, a pretty positive influence in terms of building capability in that country. In Kazakhstan, I would say we were a major, major part. Our company was a major part in building the country of Kazakhstan. And in fact, that it's been able to survive as a growing country outside the former Soviet Union. I would say the project that we're involved in has been the single most thing that's created the infrastructure and created certainly revenue in Kazakhstan. So, I mean, we frankly are in many ways in the nation building business. But there are enormous difficulties, and you're right. We need to be adding more value in the country. In lots of places, we're in Nigeria, for instance, we're building what we call a gas-to-liquids plant. So a lot of the gas that's currently being flared and has been for many, many years offshore, just burned because it was a useless product and they can't use it in Nigeria. We're bringing it onshore. We're building a state-of-the-art plant to turn this gas into diesel fuel. And so Nigeria will be exporting very, very highly sophisticated, environmentally, preferred diesel fuel that'll probably go to Japan, it'll go to a couple of countries in Europe, maybe California, places where they have very, very tight specifications. So we're doing more and more to build facilities and to build the components in the country and then to upgrade the value of the products in the country. But we're still, you're right, in a lot of places exporting oil. I know just about every country in the world. Certainly the UK, when I was kind of in the UK and the oil industry in the UK was just getting started, there were huge requirements in the UK to build facilities in the UK and to use UK technology and force the industry to do that. And as a result, the UK is a very thriving oil industry today. And frankly, as a lot of people think, Houston's the center of the oil world, but I think Aberdeen's the center of the oil world. But I probably get a lot of argument about that. But anyway, it really worked. So, I mean, the countries are pushing. We are, working with them to do more in the countries. But there is a limit. This is some of this technology is just really very, very sophisticated, and sometimes it just can't get manufactured in a lot of countries in the world. On the human rights thing, I mean, obviously, we stand for sort of universal human rights. I mean, we were one of the original signatories of the Sullivan Principles. For what it's worth, I'm on the board of the Leon Sullivan Foundation, which is, which is the keeper of the Sullivan Principles. The Sullivan Principles have been, lots of other codes like that have been developed over the years, but Sullivan Principles still stand for something, certainly in Africa. We're big supporters of a project that was started by Tony Blair in the UK called the Extractive Industries Transparency Index, I think, EITI, which is all about transparency, which is a big problem and a big opportunity in a way. If we can these revenue flows can be more transparent. This EITI organization, sort of an NGO that really companies report what revenues they're giving to the government. The government reports what revenues they're receiving from the companies, and this EITI organization kind of match them up, and if there's missing money, then it becomes transparent. So the whole issue of transparency is something that's very important, and I think in order to get more of the revenue and more of the benefits of this activity, this oil production, to the local people, one of the first elements is transparency and sort of the ridding of corruption. So, I mean, we're deeply involved in a lot of these things, but these are, better than I do, it takes more than a company to change Zimbabwe. It takes more than a company to change Nigeria. It takes more than a company to change South Africa. But we can be a positive influence, and I think, frankly, American companies are, and I think our company in particular is.
We only have a couple minutes left. Let's take a question over here on the left.
Yes, my name is Raymond Learzy. I'd just like to point out one thing before I ask my question. You raised a bottle of Fiji water and you compared it to the price of gasoline. I love Fiji water. I drink it all the time. but I cannot take my car to my tap and That's fill
right.
it up.
That's right.
And if I don't like, if I happen not to have any bottle of Fiji water around, I can go to my tap right. and fill it up at no cost.
That's right. That's what I said. Gasoline is a must-buy product, so that's part of the issue.
Yeah, but the implication was very different.
The implication was it costs more. That was my only point.
No, you said that Fiji water cost, that a bottle of bottled water was the equivalent in terms of value, in terms of need, as a gallon of gasoline.
He was talking about the price.
I just said you have to pay more for it. That's
ask
all.
Your ask your question.
No value okay. judgment at all. Just
my question. I'd like to get some clarification, please. You said that price of oil was determined by the marketplace, and you compared it to the market for orange juice. Now I'm a little confused. Perhaps you can clarify this for me. OPEC. Does that stand for orange juice producing, exporting countries?
Well, you have a serious question.
Obviously,
sir.
Not.
That's my question.
Okay.
No, it doesn't.
All right. Let's have a question over here on the right.
Hi, I'm Angela Caldwell, and I was just curious. Besides looking for alternatives, to be used in the future, what are you and your company doing now to help protect the environment?
Oh gosh. Well, I mean. First of all, we're producing fuels that are creating a fraction of the emissions that that fuels produced 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago. So, I mean, the fuel that you burn in your gasoline, your petrol tank today is completely different from the fuel. It does the same thing as far as you're concerned, but the emissions are enormously less. So in terms of air quality, just look in Los Angeles, just look in the cities of the United States and look in the cities of the world. They're a lot cleaner than they were, a few years ago. So our products are much, much cleaner. In terms of, the future environmental issue, which is carbon dioxide, one of the things I've been talking about is the importance of trying to crack the code, if you like, or trying to find ways to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, carbon emissions. And, we're probably in the sort of development phase of probably the biggest carbon sequestration project in the world, which is the Gorgon gas project in Australia, where we're going to sequester in the ground, which has never been done before in anything like this scale, carbon dioxide, as opposed to in the old days, we'd have put it up in the air. So there's a lot of work going on to sequester carbon. I mean, on all of our projects, the environmental requirements, we measure spills. If we spill an eyedropper of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, we have to report it to the government.
Right, but also not
and,
only...
And so our spills and our emissions are dramatically lower year over year than they've ever been before. So,
yeah.
I mean, right across the board, we're doing a lot of things for the environment.
And not only the air quality that obviously has been improved, but also as far as where you're drilling?
Well, I mean, the places where we're drilling, if you look for a big example, the only place in the United States offshore where we're able to drill is in part of the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we had two 100-year storms here a couple of years ago, Katrina and Rita. They destroyed 1,000 wells in the Gulf of Mexico. They tore them up, they ripped the pipe off, they ripped the wellhead off. Not one leaked. Not one. Whereas everybody remembers 19, or you don't, but I do, 1969 Santa Barbara Channel, when there was, the industry, not our company, although we bought the company that it was, had an oil leak, and everybody remembers that, and everybody thinks about offshore drilling as this dirty activity. 1,000 wells were destroyed in the Gulf of Mexico, not one leaked. I mean, we can do this with today's technology and with today's requirements, frankly. Society has put requirements on us. We've developed technology that allows us to do it. We can do this stuff very, very cleanly. And, I think maybe the Gulf of Mexico story is about the best example.
Look, it's past 9 o'clock. That is our closing time. Thanks to you. Peter Robertson, for being here, and all of you. Thank you, and onward with the Aspen Ideas Festival.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks.